Chapter 7. A Struggling North Korea. Stagnation, Crisis, and Survival. From Great Leap to Slow Crawl. The Economic Slowdown. October is a beautiful month in Korea. The skies are deep blue, the air is cool but not chilly, and the leaves are turning bright colors. It was at this time of year in 1980 that the Korean Workers' Party held its sixth party congress. The highlight of the congress was the main address by the Supreme Leader, Kim Il-sung. He stood before the delegates for several hours, reviewing his regime's achievements. He had much to be proud of. In less than three decades, the country had recovered from the appalling destruction of the Korean War to become the second most urbanized and industrialized nation in Asia. It had virtually wiped out illiteracy, created a powerful military force, and skillfully carved out a position of independence from its two giant communist neighbors, China and the Soviet Union, while receiving aid and support from both. The nation was still divided, but Kim was confident that history was on his side and that the reunification of the peninsula under Pyongyang was inevitable. Kim may not have been fully aware of it, but the achievements of North Korea's revolution were largely behind him. Economic growth was coming to a halt, and the prospects for reuniting the country under North Korea's leadership were slipping away. It was falling behind its southern rival in terms of industrial output and standard of living. In fact, things were about to go very wrong for the DPRK. South Korea's economy would continue booming, as it was about to embark on a path to democratization and international respectability, while the North was to enter a period of economic decline and isolation. In a decade, its very survival would be uncertain. Economic growth rates up to the early 1970s were high, in fact, very high. But then they began to flag. When the regime launched its six-year plan for 1971 to 76, it decided to emulate the five-year plan of 1957 by completing it ahead of schedule. By October 10, 1975, the 30th anniversary of the founding of the KWP. To spur production, the regime relied on its method of throwing masses of people on projects, having them work extra, volunteer hours, and bombarding them with exhortations to further the revolution by meeting production targets. Millions toiled in speed battles and days of extra labor to meet that goal. When the big anniversary came in October 1975, sure enough, the regime declared a complete success. All targets had been met by the projected date. It was another heroic victory of the revolution. In reality, however, the plan had fallen far short of its goals. Never admitting failure, the state urged workers to meet the same targets in 1976, despite the fact that it had been announced that they had already been met. Then it added an extra year in 1977 to meet the same targets again. Then a new seven-year plan was announced that quietly incorporated some of the old targets. Clearly, there were problems. By the early 1980s, the economy was barely growing at all. This was particularly alarming since its southern rival was performing so well. Sadly, for the patient, hard-working people of North Korea, the only solution the regime came up with was the application of more labor. Everyone was put to work. Schools frequently closed so that students could take part in projects. The huge prison population was put to work, and soldiers worked on construction sites and helped with harvesting crops. On Fridays, most offices were closed so staff could be sent out to perform manual labor. Yet the state was achieving diminishing returns, really virtually no returns, on all this investment and extra effort. Obtaining foreign currency became a central problem. North Korea needed foreign exchange to buy foreign technology to replace its outdated equipment and to provide a few luxuries for the elite. It didn't produce much that the rest of the world wanted. Its industrial goods were so shoddy that even its communist allies didn't want them. Kim Jong-il, even more concerned with this than his father, created Room 39, a special office whose mission was to find ways to obtain precious foreign currency by any means possible. And eventually, almost every means other than actually reforming the economy was employed. Much of it involved criminal enterprises. North Korean diplomats smuggled heroin and other drugs. The country produced counterfeit cigarettes, amphetamines, and eventually counterfeit U.S. bills. It was bad enough that Kim Il-sung relied on old methods that were no longer working, but he also wasted precious capital and the labor of his people on ill-conceived schemes. Like so many dictators, Kim loved grandiose projects. An example was the West Sea Barrage, an 8-kilometer-long, 5-mile system of dams and locks, essentially blocking off the mouth of the mighty Taedong River from the Yellow Sea. North Koreans are still proud of this project, the longest such structure in the world, and love showing it off to foreigners. But it was an enormous mistake. Intended to create hundreds of square kilometers of fertile farmland, it produced only some mud flats, too salty for any use, while backing up all the filth and sewage of the river, turning the surrounding land into a giant cesspool. And then there were the show projects to impress visitors or North Korea's own citizens. These included the Pyongyang-Kaesong Express Highway, which was so little used one could take a nap on it without too much worry, and the Ruchong Hotel. The latter, begun in 1987, was to be the highest hotel in the world, a 105-story structure containing 3,000 rooms and multiple revolving restaurants. Besides the fact that such a monstrous construction was hardly needed in a city that received so few visitors, the work was halted in 1992 as it neared completion due to structural and financial problems. It remained unopened, a strange, elongated pyramid shape that loomed over the city, an ugly, unavoidable presence that symbolized failure rather than progress. Reducing the vast military would have helped somewhat. Since the equal emphasis policy of the 1960s, Pyongyang had attempted to develop both the economy and the military simultaneously. It constructed an entire second economy devoted to making military vehicles instead of tractors and weapons instead of civilian goods. Its vast armed forces swallowed up much of its labor force as well as its limited resources. Determined to more than match South Korea's military despite having half that country's population, Kim created an incredibly large army. By 1990, more than 1 million out of a population of only 20 million men and some women served in the military. Another 7 million were in the reserves. All men had to serve for as many as 13 years of active duty, with 7 or 8 being the norm. The DPRK was perhaps the most militarized nation on Earth. For a while, it appeared Pyongyang might learn from China and reform its economy. All signs indicated that Kim Il-sung's regime was at least flirting with the idea. Instead, rather than following the Chinese path, Kim looked to Moscow for help. The Soviet Union had long provided valuable economic assistance by exporting petroleum and other products to North Korea at nominal prices, as well as by supplying military equipment. In the early 1980s, the Kremlin decided that it needed to offer more assistance in order to prevent the DPRK from falling into Beijing's orbit. It stepped up its aid and sent in experts to assist on development projects. This helped keep things afloat for a few years. But even with Moscow's support, the economy was stagnating. Waiting for the revolutionary forces, the threat from the South. In 1980, Kim Il-sung's hope of seeing the South brought under his leadership was not yet a fantasy. He could find many promising signs that the people of the ROK would rise up against their government. In fact, 1980 was a terrible year for the ROK. The assassination of Park Chung-hee in 1979 led to a year of political unrest. The economy tanked. A bloody uprising against the military government took place in the city of Gwangju, and there was serious labor unrest. Meanwhile, some radical youths and leftist intellectuals expressed admiration for the DPRK. Even the long-term U.S. commitment to defend the South was uncertain. President Carter had called for the withdrawal of troops in 1977, although the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979 and the increase in East-West tension that followed made that unlikely in the immediate future. Under these circumstances, it was easy for Kim to imagine his three-part strategy coming to fruition. However, the geopolitical situation soon turned against Pyongyang. In 1981, the political order in the South stabilized, and the hardline anti-communist administration of U.S. President Reagan reaffirmed its commitment to defend the ROK. But the biggest challenge was the rise of the ROK on the world stage. By 1980, South Korea had already surpassed the North in industrial output and living standards by a considerable margin. In 1981, it resumed its roaring economic growth, which continued unabated for the next decade, a sharp contrast to the DPRK. And the world was taking notice. Starting in the early 1980s, developing countries, which Pyongyang considered its playground, were turning their interest toward the South, which had more to offer in aid and as an example of successful development. Even the DPRK's friends in the non-aligned movement were busy opening relations with the ROK, having become uncomfortable with Kim's over-the-top cult, his acts of terrorism against the South, and his diplomats' involvement in smuggling. The awarding of the 1988 Summer Olympics to Seoul, a manifestation of the rising respectability of the ROK, had a profound effect on the relationship between the two Koreas. It granted a kind of international legitimacy to a country that had previously been seen as a war-torn U.S. client state. It was the South's opportunity to show the world its economic miracle, to step out of the shadows and build bridges to China, the Soviet Union, and other countries that had previously ignored it or treated it with hostility. And the South Korean government made the most of it. Even Beijing and Moscow, Pyongyang's main allies, sent athletes for training in South Korea, and began reporting on the country more favorably. For Kim Il-sung, this was bad news. He responded by starting a campaign to have the Olympics moved, then lobbied to have the Games co-hosted by Pyongyang. He sent his foreign minister, Kim Nam-won, to dissuade his allies from participating, but with no success. Then he tried to scare people away with reports of a raging AIDS epidemic. When this failed, Kim turned to acts of terror. He tried to blow up South Korean President Chun Doo-hwan during a visit to Burma in October 1983, missing him but killing four members of Chun's cabinet. His agents planted a bomb in Seoul International Airport in 1986 and blew up a Korean Air passenger plane heading for Seoul, killing all aboard. When none of these succeeded in deterring the Olympics, Pyongyang tried an international boycott. This was a pathetic failure. Only Cuba, Albania, Madagascar, and the Seychelles joined the embargo. Everyone else came. The Olympics were a big success for the South. The world was duly impressed by the big, modern, clean city it saw, and China and the Soviet Union opened trade offices in Seoul. An unthinkable outcome for the North. The Games were also accompanied by South Korea's successful and mostly bloodless transition to democracy. The days of chronic political instability and political repression in the South were coming to an end. Nothing could have been more threatening to the DPRK than the rise of South Korea. The entire rationale for the North Korean regime was that it was the true vehicle by which all North Koreans could achieve their dream of a unified, prosperous, strong, respected, and independent state. To keep this idea alive, Pyongyang depicted South Korea as a true hell on earth. Actually, hell would probably be an improvement over what the Southerners supposedly endured. News reports, even textbooks, told of the hunger and physical deprivation of the people of the South, the cruel barbarity they suffered at the hands of the fiendish American wolf bastards and the collaborators. Farmers were driven off the land needed for military bases. Workers were boiled alive in chemical vats and American-owned pharmaceutical plants. The stories outdid each other. What kept the people from hanging themselves in this telling was the hope that they would someday be liberated by the North and live under the great leader Kim Il-sung. But by the end of the 1980s, even Kim must have understood that the South was not on the verge of collapse and that his state was falling hopelessly behind it in economic development. innumerable crises. By the late 1980s, the international situation for North Korea went from unfavorable to really bad. Only a decade after Kim Il-sung reviewed his achievements with pride and confidence in his hours-long speech, the ground was shifting under his feet. In Eastern Europe, Pyongyang's communist allies were collapsing, with the overthrow of Kim's friend and admirer, the Romanian dictator Nicolae Ceaușescu, in late 1989, coming as a particular shock. Then there was China, which was establishing friendlier relations with the U.S. as well as with the ROK, and abandoning the Maoist model for a mixed-market social economy. But at least the Tiananmen massacre in 1989 showed the limits of China's reform. Even worse for Pyongyang were the changes in Moscow, which opened formal relations with Seoul in 1990. In 1989, the reform-minded government of Gorbachev was no longer interested in propping up Pyongyang's economy. In 1990, it announced the suspension of most aid projects and began to insist that the North begin paying market prices for its petroleum and other exports. This had to be done with foreign currency that Pyongyang didn't have. The result was an immediate economic contraction and severe energy shortages. North Korea had relied on generous supplies of cheap petroleum for the massive amounts of fertilizers it used on its fields, for powering its trains and tractors, and generating its electricity, so the loss of Soviet petroleum was a particularly hard blow. The contraction of the economy was so severe that Kim Il-sung himself, in his annual New Year's address, admitted that there were problems. It was a startling thing for him to do, since officially everything was always going well in the Democratic People's Republic, as it continued on its revolutionary path. Failures were almost never admitted. The economic hardships, including food shortages, worsened. The regular food rations people received had already been reduced in 1987, and were now being reduced further, causing real hunger. Then there was the nuclear crisis. Pyongyang had been working on developing nuclear weapons, as well as missiles, since the 1970s. By 1990, American satellites showed the North Korean program was large enough to actually produce an atomic bomb. This, along with their testing of explosives used for detonating a nuclear device, raised concerns. The U.S. lobbied for Pyongyang to admit international inspectors. Instead, in 1993, North Korea announced its intention to withdraw from the non-proliferation treaty it had previously signed. The ensuing crisis was so serious that the U.S. began plans for a possible military strike, calling it USFK-Op Plan 502-716. Nobody wanted war. Of course Kim would lose, but not without wreaking destruction on the South. He had more than 8,000 artillery buried in the mountainsides on the DPRK side of the DMZ, capable of carrying out a devastating retaliatory blow on Seoul, which was just 25 miles from the border. Fortunately, former U.S. President Jimmy Carter arrived in Pyongyang in June 1994 and signed an agreement with Kim Il-sung, averting possible conflict. Under this pact, known as the Agreed Framework, the DPRK would open its nuclear program to inspection in exchange for the construction of two nuclear power plants by South Korea, to be financed by the U.S. and Japan. Kim also agreed to a summit meeting with the South Korean president. It proved only a temporary respite in ongoing tensions with the U.S. over the nuclear issue. The summit conference between Kim Il-sung and his South Korean counterpart never took place, as Kim died several weeks after the agreement. His sudden death was still another crisis for the regime. At 82, Kim was a physically vigorous man who showed no obvious signs of ill health. The 46 years of Kim's rule, even more if his emergence under the Soviet occupation is counted, was so long that most North Koreans had known no other leader. He set the record for the longest dictatorship in history, broken only by Fidel Castro, who ruled 1 year longer before stepping down in 2006. During that time, Kim dominated his country in a way that no other modern leader had. It was hard to imagine the DPRK without him. The sun becomes the sun. North Korea under Kim Jong-il. Many observers expected the death of Kim Il-sung would lead to a crisis. How could the regime continue without the person who had dominated it so completely? Unlike most modern dictators, however, Kim had prepared for his succession carefully. By the time he died, his eldest son, Kim Jong-il, controlled all key party offices, had placed his loyalists in top bureaucratic positions, and was the commander of the Korean People's Army. That is to say, he held almost every lever of power. As a result, the transition went smoothly, with no major purges. Short, with his elevated shoes, his bouffant hairdo, Kim Jong-il hardly looked like a leader, nor did he sound like one. It wasn't that his voice or manner of speaking was strange. Rather, he almost never spoke in public at all. When he became leader in 1994, despite being seen everywhere on TV and on posters, and even appearing with his father on the badges people wore in public, he had never given a public address. It was rumored that he had a speech impediment, but foreigners who met him found him witty and a good conversationalist. After coming to power, he continued his practice of being seen but not heard by the general public. Nevertheless, the eccentricity of his appearance, and sometimes his behavior aside, Kim Jong-il was a skilled political operative who had more than 20 years of experience at the center of power before his father's death. He needed all these skills, because soon after he came to power, he had to guide the country through its greatest crisis, the famine. The horror of North Korea's famine. On June 26, 1995, it started raining in North Korea. This was not unusual. Late June normally marks the arrival of the summer monsoons, when the peninsula gets much of its rainfall. That year, however, it rained continually for 10 days, accumulating a total of 23 inches. Floods occurred over much of the country, inundating many of the nation's rice paddies and destroying a sizable portion of the crop. As a result, the country, already facing a serious food shortage, was now swept by a famine that would continue for the next 4 years. It is difficult to say how many people died prematurely due to food shortages. Famines are usually accompanied by confusion, so deaths can be overlooked. People move about, and it is difficult to separate starvation and malnutrition from other causes of death. In North Korea, calculating the death toll was made more challenging by the closed nature of the regime, which treated even routine statistics as state secrets. It is not surprising, then, that estimates vary so widely. Some experts and outside groups reported up to 3 million of the nation's 20 million people perished. That's at the high end of credible estimates. Low-end estimates are about a tenth of that number. Even a mid-range estimate of 1 million is still a terrible number. The heavy rains were just the tipping point in a country where famine-like conditions had already been underway. North Korea had never been able to feed itself adequately. The challenges of mountainous terrain, a short growing season, and a population that increased rapidly after 1953, doubling in a generation, were compounded by what could only be described as terribly short-sighted agricultural practices. Socialist farming was never successful anywhere, but to compensate for its inadequacies, most communist states allotted farm families small private plots to grow food to sell at markets. A substantial portion of the food consumed in the Soviet Union and Vietnam, for example, came from these plots. In North Korea, however, the only private plots were too tiny to produce anything other than some chili peppers and a few supplementary vegetables for a family. Private markets were extremely restricted and could not include grain. Being unable to go grocery shopping, the North Korean people were dependent on the food distribution system, which supplied everyone with the basics. The most important staple was grain, which was allotted to families based on the number of members. Soldiers, government officials, and men in heavy industries got the most, those in light industry less. Working women received more than housewives. Old people and children received the least. The amount was barely adequate for basic needs. What all Koreans wanted was rice, but there was never enough, so it was supplemented with other less desirable grains, mostly corn. The ratio of rice to corn depended on social status. For most, the percentage of rice declined in the 1980s and 1990s as corn was a bit easier to grow, if not as tasty or nutritious. Food rations were cut when there was a harvest shortfall. This happened regularly from the late 1980s on. When the flow of Soviet aid and petroleum for fertilizer and fuels stopped, the results were catastrophic. Hunger became widespread. Then, starting in 1995, the entire public distribution system broke down, and millions received no food at all. One solution would have been to import food, but the regime needed what little foreign funds it had for weapons components and extravagances for the elite. All famines are horrific events, but this one was unusual. Unlike most famines, which hit rural areas hardest, this one affected urban dwellers. Millions of city folk suffered from severe hunger. Many died at home, while others collapsed in the streets. Train stations and other public places were filled with abandoned children, who were called swallows, begging and scrounging for food, their parents either dead or too weak to assist them. Factories stopped operating, since most of the employees were out foraging in the hillsides or searching for food. Classrooms were empty because children were too hungry or weak to attend, and the teachers were out looking for food or were themselves too weak to show up. The hardest-hit region was the Northeast. The cities there began to look like ghost towns with empty streets, since people had left in search of food or were too weak to leave home. Everything that could be eaten was consumed. Dogs and livestock disappeared. People made green porridge out of leaves, grass, and twigs, which provided the illusion of food but only caused diarrhea. Malnutrition took a particularly heavy toll on the children, with many suffering from severely stunted growth. Foreigners commented on how small and young they looked for their age. The nation's industrial plants stopped functioning, and managers and employees stripped them of their machinery for scrap metal. Smugglers conducted a large illegal cross-border trade in scrap metal and anything else that could be sold in China. Crossing over to China became increasingly easy as border guards, often hungry themselves, were bribed to look the other way. The old system of internal control over travel broke down as hundreds of thousands took to the road looking for food or work. Even soldiers and government office workers wandered off in search of food. Kim Jong-il openly called for international assistance. The World Food Program responded, as did the UN International Children's Emergency Fund. They were joined by food relief assistance from some European countries, Japan, South Korea, and even the United States. A number of private agencies also provided assistance. By 1997, 2 out of 5 North Koreans were being fed by the international community. Pyongyang, so secretive, could hardly have been thrilled about the large number of foreigners witnessing its economic failure. Relief workers complained that they were not given direct access to victims, that they were being denied entry into many areas of the country, that they were uncertain whether the food aid was reaching its intended targets or, as rumor had it, was being diverted to the military. Some aid agencies and governments, frustrated with the restrictions under which they were being forced to operate, pulled out. Yet it is surprising that international relief workers were permitted entry at all. That such an isolated, secretive country, so concerned about its people finding out the reality behind the wildly distorted depiction of the outside world they had been given, and so concerned about self-reliance, could open itself to foreign aid teams was certainly remarkable. This was a contrast to China's famine in the late 1950s and early 1960s, when Mao's government refused to so much as admit there was a famine, even as many millions perished. But the risk for Kim Jong-il and his government paid off. By the year 2000, the worst of the famine was over. Food assistance, most of it coming from South Korea and the U.S., continued for a few more years. And the regime managed to survive intact. Marketization from below. The transformation of North Korea in the wake of famine. The entire totalitarian system Kim Il-sung and his comrades had constructed appeared to be unraveling. Many outside observers saw a country and a regime on the verge of collapse. faced with the loss of its Soviet patron and economic decline, and with its people starving, internationally isolated, with its legitimacy threatened by the rise of South Korea, the North Korean state appeared to be doomed. Remarkably, however, the regime managed to avoid the fate of Albania, Romania, and others among its communist allies by adjusting its economy and modifying its ideology. Adjustments in the economic system took place from the top and, perhaps more profoundly, from below. The near-total command economy that had provided for every citizen's needs broke down. The old institutions remained intact, and the state continued to call itself socialist, but in reality it was being replaced by a kind of improvised system, half socialist and half entrepreneurial. No longer able to rely on the state to provide for them, ordinary people looked to the informal economy. All kinds of small businesses arose, and markets sprang up everywhere. Government organizations became involved in businesses as well. Many engaged in export of commodities to China or made deals with Chinese firms interested in the country's mineral wealth. Others exported seafood, coal, and iron. Members of government agencies and the military who had access to vehicles hired them out or ran transport services that replaced the decrepit rail service as the main way to transport goods and people. Agricultural produce and goods imported from China were sold freely. Items that would have been unimaginable previously, such as used Chinese VCRs, became commonplace in the country, along with pirated South Korean TV shows and music videos. All this presented an enormous challenge to the state and its control over society, and in fact it did lose a measure of control. It could no longer prevent people from moving or traveling, and cracks in the information cordon that had almost completely cut off the population from any knowledge of the outside world appeared. Rather than stopping the shift to a more mobile population and market-oriented economy, or promoting it, the Kim Jong-il regime chose a middle ground to control, contain, and also to adjust to a market economy. Government agencies had always been on the lookout for ways to obtain foreign exchange. Now they were encouraged to obtain a large portion of the funding through entrepreneurial activity. Realizing that the society was becoming a money economy, Kim Jong-il decided to facilitate that process. He shifted the country to a more money-based economy, legalized private markets, and permitted farmers to sell some of their products. He allowed a variety of consumer products, including imports from China, to be sold openly. The government issued travel permits to merchants to go to China and trade. People were allowed to own bicycles and even automobiles if they had the money to buy them. Almost anything could be purchased on the open market. Modest reforms continued after his death. In 2012 and 2014, changes in agricultural policies increased the percentage of the crops farmers could keep for themselves or sell. Work units were reduced to the size of family units, and the private plots allotted to farm families expanded from 100 square meters, 1,076 square feet, to 3,300, 32,292 square feet. Factory managers were given independence to buy and sell materials and products, to hire workers, and to set wages. More and more private restaurants and shops opened. None of these measures were revolutionary, but they worked just well enough to keep the economy afloat, mitigate the worst poverty, and give the state just enough revenues to import parts for its military and luxury goods to keep the elite happy. An interesting part of the country's economic pragmatism was its trade with South Korea. If ordinary people came into too much contact with their southerner compatriots and learned just how prosperous and free they were, it would be a serious threat to the regime. But the DPRK needed the economic aid and foreign currency the South could provide. So for a decade, until relations soured and North Korea's economy had recovered somewhat, it accepted large amounts of rice, cooking oil, fuel oil, and other aid from the ROK. It also permitted South Korean tourists to visit the famed Diamond Mountains, just north of the border near the East Coast. A resort built by the Hyundai Corporation accommodated southern tourists, allowing them to spend their money and vacation in the mountains without coming into any contact with North Korean people. An even more ambitious project was the Kaesong Industrial Complex, built in the city just a few miles north of the DMZ. Over 100 South Korean firms eventually opened up plants there, taking advantage of North Korea's cheap labor. At one point, 40,000 North Koreans worked for these firms. Again, however, contact between Northerners and Southerners was kept at a minimum. The racial nationalist state, from Marxism-Leninism to ultranationalism. Adjusting its economy to deal with changing realities helped to ensure the survival of the Kim dynastic state, but it still faced threats to its legitimacy. How could the regime maintain its credibility when it could no longer claim it was leading the Korean people down the road to prosperity and progress? How could it deal with the collapse of communist systems elsewhere? How could it pretend it was paradise on earth when obviously well-fed foreigners were distributing food aid? How could it maintain the myth that the impoverished, oppressed masses in South Korea were looking to the North for liberation when the people could see a very different reality on the pirated videos that became so popular? To deal with these challenges, the North Korean regime had to refashion the official story it told to its people about itself and its place in the world. Because Chuche thought had largely replaced Marxism-Leninism as the ideological foundation of society, it was insulated from the collapse of communist regimes elsewhere. The wonderful thing about Chuche thought was that it was so vacuous that it could be interpreted to mean anything the authorities wanted it to mean. But this was not enough to deal with the changing reality of the world around it, so state propaganda organs turned to a more extreme blood-and-soil ultranationalism. In the early 1990s, there was greater emphasis on celebrating the country's unique heritage. Traditional holidays, such as the Lunar New Year's celebration and the Chuseok Autumn Festival, were revived. But the state went far beyond this in linking itself to an ancient and unique historical past. Following suggestions by the great leader, archaeologists discovered an ancient and probably fictitious Daedong civilization, adding to the nation's antiquity. In 1993, even more amazingly, archaeologists discovered the grave of Hangun, who had previously been dismissed in DPRK texts as an ancient myth. It was now announced that he was a real person who had lived 5,000 years ago. Korea was an original civilization, as old, if not older, than China, Egypt, or any other, and Pyongyang had been the center of it since the distant past. The grave of King Hangun was made into a tourist site. DPRK authorities didn't stop there. They proclaimed that Korea not only had a unique, independently developed culture, but the Korean people belonged to a distinctive race. It turned out they were direct descendants of Pithecanthropus, an early human that lived in the Daedong Basin in North Korea 1 million years ago. Not even the Nazis had gone so far as to assert that Germans had evolved separately from other races. Koreans, in this new reinterpretation of history, were a special, pure, unmixed race, a glorious, virtuous people, but one that was always threatened by foreigners. Foreigners sought to subjugate Korea and violate its purity. Fortunately for Koreans today, they had this brilliant, loving Kim family who provided the leadership needed to keep outsiders at bay, preventing them from blocking the Korean people in their path to progress. The Americans, the Japanese, and others lorded over half the Korean people and were trying to subjugate the free half in the DPRK. The wise leadership and the heroic, powerful Korean People's Army were foiling these efforts. Economic problems, including the famine, were blamed on the foreign imperialists who used economic sanctions and other methods to bring about the DPRK's economic collapse, although the regime could force them to supply some aid. North Koreans were going through an arduous march, a term used to refer to the long journey Kim Il-sung had taken to escape the pursuing Japanese army in the late 1930s. In the early 2000s, references to South Korean poverty were replaced by reports of the humiliation they endured under the thumb of the imperialists and their lackeys. They weren't starving, but they lacked something more important: freedom from foreign oppression. North Korea, the birthplace of Korea, was the last great bastion of Korean independence and ethnic racial purity. Besides moving the ideology in a more racial nationalist anti-foreign direction, there was a greater emphasis of the military. The regime had boasted of its progress in making the country prosperous and powerful. In the 1990s, the emphasis shifted from prosperous to powerful. In 1999, Kim Jong-il began his military-first policy, indicating that strengthening the DPRK military would take priority. The nation might suffer economically, but as long as it was militarily strong, it would be free. How effective was this new ideological evolution? Outsiders wondered how much of all of this most North Korean people believed. Cut off from much knowledge of the larger world, they seemed to accept a good deal of it. At least most people did, although there was also widespread cynicism. Still, there was no sign of open dissent, and most people were busy just struggling to get by. Some did leave, at first just a few, but by 2010, thousands were crossing over to China. Most were just trying to earn money to bring back to their families. It was a risky move. The illegal North Korean population in China, numbering perhaps 250,000, had to dodge Chinese authorities who would deport them. Those that got caught either had to pay hefty bribes or suffer imprisonment. Occasionally, people who crossed illegally into China were shot when they returned. Some North Koreans, mostly those who lived near the border and had greater access to news about the outside world, tried to defect to South Korea. This was extremely difficult, as it usually involved not only crossing the border but making one's way across China to either Mongolia or Laos. By the early 2010s, about 20,000 North Korean refugees were living in the south. A few managed to pay smugglers to bring family members out as well. The politics of survival. North Korea and the rest of the world. In its new form, the story created to justify the regime and give meaning to the sacrifices of its people required three things: maintaining a constant flow of international crises and confrontations, keeping restrictions on contact with foreigners, especially with South Koreans, and demonstrating the DPRK's military strength and progress. Kim Jong-il's relations with the rest of the world were based on these three requirements, as well as the need to acquire foreign currency, whether by aid, trade, or other means, to import weapon parts and luxuries for the elite. The trickiest aspect of DPRK's foreign policy was its relationship with South Korea. ROK President Kim Dae-jung, who had been democratically elected in 1998, was keen on improving relations with his sunshine policy, a strategy derived from Aesop's fable about a contest between the wind and the sun over who could get a man to take off his coat. The wind blew furiously, but this only made the man wrap his coat more tightly around him, whereas the sun succeeded just by shining and bringing warmth. Kim Dae-jung tried easing tensions by offering a hand of friendship. In 2000, he traveled to Pyongyang, met with Kim Jong-il, and promised the North more aid. They agreed to open a rail link, to allow reunions of divided families, and to carry out cultural exchanges. But Kim Jong-il, happy to get the aid, could not afford to provide either peace or too much in-person contact. There were token gestures, such as having the two nations march together at the Sydney Olympics in 2000, but most of the cultural exchanges and family reunions that were promised never took place. Kim Jong-il held another summit meeting with Kim Dae-jung's successor, Roh Moo-hyun, in 2007, but again promises of further exchanges were not carried out. Instead, Kim Jong-il pursued a policy of obtaining whatever foreign aid and foreign currency he could, accepting aid packages from the south, allowing some tourists in the Diamond Mountains, opening up the Kaesong Industrial Complex. but restricted any meaningful contact between his people and their compatriots south of the DMZ. Meanwhile, he continued his policy of military confrontation. In 1999, he sent naval vessels into what had been accepted as ROK territorial waters, leading to a clash between the two countries' ships. In 2001, he moved missiles near the border. Aid, trade, and tourist dollars from the South were welcome, but not at the cost of undermining the myth of a hostile South being used as a base for imperialist designs on the DPRK. In 2008, on the very day the new president in Seoul was presenting his plan to help the North develop its economy, a South Korean tourist was shot at the Diamond Mountains Resort. Kim refused to apologize, and the resort was closed. The North confiscated it without compensation. Seoul responded by suspending all aid. By then, Pyongyang had decided to live without it and get by with trade to China. In March of 2010, the North Koreans sank an ROK destroyer with a torpedo, killing 50 South Korean sailors. In November of that year, the DPRK artillery shelled the South Korean island of Yongpyeong, killing 4 people and causing popular outrage in the South. North Korea pursued a similar strategy with the United States, occasionally offering gestures to improve relations in return for aid, while also setting off confrontations and creating crises. In 2002, relations with the U.S. worsened when it appeared the North was cheating on its promise to suspend nuclear weapons development. The agreed framework, under which Pyongyang promised to halt its nuclear weapons program in exchange for the construction of 2 peaceful nuclear reactors, came to an end. In 2003, Pyongyang announced it was withdrawing from the Non-Proliferation Treaty of Nuclear Weapons, the second time since 1993 it had done so. But then it agreed to a series of 6-party talks with the U.S., South Korea, China, Russia, and Japan about its nuclear program, although no progress was ever made. All the while, the DPRK was busy figuring out how to build a nuclear bomb. They succeeded in detonating a small one in 2006, which was followed by a return to negotiations. In 2007, Pyongyang agreed to allow International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors in and shut down its nuclear reactor at Yongbyon. It even destroyed a facility in 2008. But giving in to U.S. demands that the North surrender its nuclear weapons was not a serious option for a regime intent on demonstrating its military progress to its people while also protecting itself from foreign intervention. The U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, one of the 3 countries that President Bush labeled the Axis of Evil, along with Iran and North Korea, only made the acquisition of atomic bombs more urgent. By 2009, Pyongyang was willing to lose all U.S. aid in order to step up its weapons program. It detonated a larger atomic bomb that year and continued its missile development with the aim of building an intercontinental ballistic missile that could reach the U.S. North Korea's nuclear weapons program was troubling to all the powers, including its only ally, China. The Chinese supported UN sanctions against the regime following the 2009 test, but the regime was still willing to risk international condemnation to continue with its program. Washington tried many ways of putting pressure on the regime. It froze North Korean assets in a Macau bank that was being used to launder money and interfered with its efforts to export weapons. None of these succeeded in crippling the economy, however. Trade with China was increasing enough to both keep the economy afloat and obtain enough foreign currency to buy parts for weapons development and purchase BMWs and cognac for the ruling elite. Efforts by the international community, led by the U.S., to halt North Korea's development of weapons of mass destruction were largely futile, since the regime regarded these arms as essential for protecting itself and impressing its people. Beijing could have stopped trade, but feared that doing so would precipitate an economic collapse in North Korea. The great fear was that if the regime collapsed, a flood of refugees would come across the Manchurian border, and South Korea would take over the North. Besides the concern of chaos next door was the worry of having a united, democratic Korea, allied with the U.S. and with Japan, on its border. Additionally, the fall of a communist ally, even a rather disgusting one, could be interpreted by its own people as weakness, or even worse, embolden those discontented with the Chinese communist regime. China therefore made token gestures in support of sanctions. It wanted Pyongyang to stop developing atomic bombs, fearing it would go too far in provoking South Korea and the U.S. Yet at the same time, it allowed trade to flourish. Exports of coal, iron, rare earth, and other minerals to China made up most of its international trade. Chinese businesses even contracted out textile production to low-cost North Korea. The goods were then re-imported and tagged with a Made in China label. The Manchurian border city of Dandong, across the Yalu River from Xinhuizhou, boomed with the cross-border trade. Meanwhile, Pyongyang employed all kinds of means for earning foreign exchange. Despite sanctions, it sold weapons to various governments, from Egypt to Myanmar. It operated a chain of restaurants in Asia. It continued to sell knockoff brand-name cigarettes and narcotics. And it also engaged in insurance fraud, bilking Lloyd's of London out of millions in false maritime claims. It sent laborers to toil in logging camps in Siberia, where they lived under prison-like security, and dispatched workers to countries from Poland to Zimbabwe. It abandoned its attempt to present itself as a progressive model of development to the Third World, and more or less accepted its status as an international pariah, although it could never admit its fallen place in the world to its own people. Kim Il-sung reincarnated. Kim Jong-un's succession to the throne. In 2008, Kim Jong-il had a stroke. This was never publicly announced, but after an absence, he appeared on TV looking thin, weak, and ill. It might have been a subtle way of preparing the people for the next succession. The regime was so closely linked to the cult of the Kim family that it was inconceivable that anyone other than a member of the family could succeed him. The Korean people needed to be protected by this line of the noblest, wisest members of the purest of races. So Kim looked to his three sons for a successor. The eldest, Kim Jong-nam, would normally have been expected to be the anointed leader, since by tradition the eldest son took on the family business. But Kim Jong-nam had disgraced himself when he was arrested by the Japanese for trying to enter the country on a false passport. His admitted purpose, embarrassingly enough, was to visit Tokyo Disneyland. A fun-loving man, fond of drinking, gambling, and women, he just wasn't leadership material. The second son, Kim Jong-chul, was too soft, so the young Kim Jong-un was finally selected as his father's successor. In 2010, Kim Jong-un began to appear alongside his father at public functions and was shown in state media accompanying his father for on-the-spot guidance trips. The problem was that the youngest son was only in his late 20s and had little experience in governance. There was, however, no time for the long apprenticeship Kim Jong-il had undergone. The whole process was sped up, with Kim Jong-un receiving regular promotions in party and military rank. There was even less time than Kim Jong-il probably thought, for the dear leader died of a stroke in December 2011. The son immediately assumed command.